If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Incredibly ill-judged, harsh, unimaginative, stupid upbringings affected both of the future kings. They were both of them badly educated.
That was Richard Davenport Hines on the early lives of Edward VII and Edward VIII.
He was a patriot. I think he was a fool rather than a knave. I think he was taken in by Hitler. I think he thought fascism was fashionable. He went in for what was known at the time as Savile Row fascism. In other words, it was smart to be a fascist.
And that was Piers Brendan talking about Edward VIII's relationship with Nazism.
You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe. Or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to our third podcast of July 2016. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. The Penguin Monarch series is an ongoing project where a series of distinguished historians are writing short biographies of the kings and queens of Britain and England. Two of the more recent additions to the list are a pair of kings who shared the same name and the same century, King Edward VII, and his grandson, King Edward VIII. The life of Edward VII has been written by the acclaimed biographer Richard Davenport Hines, while Edward VIII's story is told by the Cambridge historian Piers Brendan. We thought it would be an interesting idea to get the two authors in the same room to discuss these fascinating kings and their very contrasting reigns. Putting the questions to them was our reviews editor, Matt Elton.
I'm Richard Davenport Hines, and I wrote Edward VII, the Cosmopolitan King.
I'm Piers Brendan, and I wrote Edward VIII, the Uncrowned King.
Fantastic, thank you. And what was it about your respective kings that appealed to you as subjects?
I was asked to do it,
okay.
and was so flattered to be part of the series that I think that I would have written the most boring monarch they could have found for me if they'd asked me. But Edward VII was tremendously exciting for me because the Edwardian age has so many parallels with the first 15, 16 years of this century. And I my book is a parable in some ways of a lot of issues of our own time.
I too was immensely flattered to be asked in such elevated company. And I was particularly attracted to Edward VIII because I'd written about the 1930s already. And he gave me a marvellous opportunity to smuggle in Republican sentiments into an into a monarchical enterprise. So I didn't have to work hard at it because his career was so deplorable and he himself was so deplorable in lots of ways. Actually, what I had to fight against was I had to fight for, really, for him. And I tried to do a balanced job because this was not in any sense a Republican polemic. It was actually an attempt to write a fair-minded biography and to stand back from him and to say, well, what could be said on his behalf, as well as how he let the monarchy down and disgraced himself.
Mm. And I was very different from appears in that respect, since I revel in being a subject, not a citizen, and a strong monarchist. And another theme of my book, I suppose, is how much more important the institution of the monarchy and the existence of the royal household can be than the individual who happens to be monarch. So that Edward VII is in many ways a selfish and destructive and exploitative man who nevertheless is dragged up in character by duty.
Yes, that is interesting. That comes across very well in your book. I mean, you don't do what Jane Ridley did, which was to say that he started off as Prince Hal and he became Henry V. You don't have that sort of what I take to be a slightly exaggerated view of his development. Although I admire Jane Ridley's book enormously, I think it's one of the best books written about the monarchy, but and you do this marvellous thing of not being influenced by sort of retrospective sycophancy as so many royal biographers are.
Well, thank you. Piers and I both had, a similar problem, which was there were fairly recent existing biographies of our subjects that were really top-notch. Jane Ridley's of Edward VII and Philip Ziegler's of Edward VIII, which are both smashing books.
Yeah.
And Ziegler's book is quite the it was allowed by the royal family to be quite the most outspoken sexually about the sexual submissiveness of its subject and the masochism of its subject.
It's interesting having you both in the same room because we can talk about things that are common between these two people and perhaps different. How much do you think their early experiences, their youth, shaped both of their kind of later years and their reign, I suppose?
Well, I think that their childhoods were both absolutely appalling. I mean, one royal functionary said that the royals are like ducks; they trample on their children, and this was very much what happened. Richard will talk about Edward VII, but it was certainly what happened to Edward VIII. As a small boy, David to the family, of course, he was bullied by his father, who was a kind of naval martinet, and who treated his children as sort of naval ratings, and bullied and berated them, and worse than that, really sort of showed them up and insisted that they must behave properly. And I mean, one of his children, Henry, under the pressure of George V's bullying, actually literally fainted. I mean, he couldn't stand up to it at all. And Edward VIII sort of, I think it may have been something to do with his curious sexual character that he eventually found himself in a state of sort of masochism, that he could only really respond to a woman who treated him in like dirt, and his first mistress, his first sort of official mistress, Frieda Dudley Ward, said to him, you know, he loved it. He couldn't do without this sort of punishment. That's what he wanted. And in a sense, the whole tragedy of Edward VIII, the falling in love with Mrs. Simpson and becoming her slave, dated back to the vile treatment that he got at the hands of his father and Queen Mary, who tried to mitigate that, but was a kind of regal marionette, and in whose veins it was, he said, was iced water. You know, that there wasn't blood there at all.
Yeah, in principle, I'm always reluctant to blame people's adult lives on their childhood, which I think got much overdone in the 20th century under Freud's influence. And I hope people are more grown up than to stay stuck in their childhoods. But in these two cases, it's certainly true that incredibly ill-judged, harsh, unimaginative, stupid upbringings affected both of the future kings. They were both very, Edward VII particularly, but both of them badly educated. Edward VII was given an education in which was designed to have no ideas in it. It was facts, figures, dates, and learning by rote of the most mechanical and awful sort, as a result of which he loathed reading books at all, occasionally read novels when he was ill and always found them pointless. And he was very, his parents were terrified that he would be dissolute and randy and drunken like his uncles and great uncles, and gave him the most Puritan upbringing. His father, Prince Albert, used to hide behind bushes in the grounds of the royal houses and watching him play to check for corruption. And the boys were given from the age of about five or six something like a 10-hour working day at schooling, and then meant to do hectic sports because of the Victorians, as you know, were obsessed with loathing of masturbation because it couldn't be sentimentalised, like everything else in Victorian England could be sentimentalised. So the whole regime was intended to leave them too exhausted for anything like that. But Edward VII was, by 19th century standards, an affectionate parent. He tried quite hard to be. He was physically demonstrative to his sons in a way that wasn't altogether conventional, and kissed the future George V very publicly at the coronation. And the death of his elder son, the Duke of Clarence, is the hinge on which his life turns. He is not a broken man, but he's broken-hearted after this and becomes much less rambunctious, much less selfish, and much more responsible in the period of his grief, which lasts for the rest of his life.
Do you think that there's any truth in that statement? It's often quoted that George V said, you know, I was terrified of my father, and I'm going to make jolly sure that my children are terrified of me. But because it's certainly true that as it was said, you know, his bellow when heard round the corridors of Buckingham Palace terrified everybody into fits. Now, did he sort of suppress George V? Because one of the most interesting things I think about your book is where you talk about the reversionary interest, the fact that that as far as Edward VII and George V was concerned, that there was no real opposition as there was between, you know, every monarch that you can think of, right up to Charles, Prince of Wales, and the Duke of Edinburgh today. You know, that this constant battle went on between the occupant of the throne and the heir.
Now, yes, and that's a very good point. Edward VII, having suffered so much but from his mother forbidding him any sort of political influence or involvement, is very keen not to repeat the errors of the past, and is conciliatory and considerate towards his heir. And they're the only monarch and heir who really work well together in 300 years. I would say that part of the trouble in George V's upbringing is his mother, Queen Alexandra, who has an unhappy marriage, is also really quite ill, lame and very deaf, and is an emotionally controlling woman to all her children, who wants to infantilize her children, who really like her daughters never to marry or leave home, and makes them as young as possible for as long as possible. That's a real influence on George V. And of course, the education of these, of both princes, was delegated to the most sterile, stuffy, panic-stricken clergy. Awful, life-diminishing human beings. Misery gutses, which both Edward VII and Edward VIII react and become playboys after this appalling Puritan mind-numbing dullness that they were subjected to by their clergy.
Yes, I agree about that. I mean Edward VIII did this ghastly thing of saying that, to explain the fact that he never read a book, that he learned not from books but from life, which is the sort of saddest cliche of the illiterate that one can think of. He actually, when he was, one of his private secretaries said that he couldn't get Edward to read even half a page of writing, given his instructions. So he played everything by ear. He did it by ear. He was completely uneducated. And, I mean, what went with that kind of philistinism was the whole practical joke syndrome, which seems to me to be very indicative of sort of royalty, that the royals were much, much more amused by when someone got their fingers stuck in the door than they would be at a bon mot or anything of that kind. I think it was a stultifying kind of upbringing all round, don't you?
Yes, and practical jokes were very important to my Prince of Wales and his circle of favourites, the Prince of Wales set, the mob, the house set. They play horrible, brutal, humiliating practical jokes on scapegoats in the circle, one of whom is a man called Sykes, whom they persecute for years. And it's because he's so fawning that he attracts this attention from the king's favourites. The royal favourites, though, get jettisoned with tremendous ruthlessness by Edward VII. People get utterly dropped because they suddenly become boring or too permanently drunken. It's worth saying that Edward VII is, I think, the first member of the first monarch for centuries, I don't know from when, who isn't a drunkard. He really quite dislikes drunkenness. His next brother down, who he's very close to, becomes an alcoholic and dies of alcohol, really. And there is much less drunkenness as a result of Edward VII in the royal household and throughout society, and that is a difference.
He made up for it by eating inordinately, didn't
yes,
he?
I mean,
Edwardian gluttony was really something extraordinary, and you give graphic details in your book, which amused me a great deal, about the kind of meals, the 12-course meals and so on.
Nauseating details rather than graphic, I think.
Terrible. Whereas, curiously enough, Edward VIII was extraordinarily austere as far as food and drink were concerned. He did occasionally get drunk, that's true, but he was almost anorexic, I think he adopted Mrs. Simpson's watchword, that was that you can never be too rich or too thin. So he didn't go in for this at all.
Edward VII had increasingly abandoned the traditional territorial aristocracy as his hosts because they couldn't afford to entertain him on the royal scale that he wanted. And this extended to food and to the quality of the shoots and to the luxuries of the houses. So he moves over from the 1880s, when the depression in land values really starts to hit the traditional aristocracy. He more and more cultivates new money, millionaires. We know a lot about the way in which he took up Jewish bankers, Jewish financiers, and rewarded them with titles. But there were also a lot of Gentiles who were brewers or whiskey men or had other industrial interests, whom he increasingly goes to stay with. And is fed by on this lavish scale and tamed by. And I do think what is interesting in both of these monarchs is the way in which they find it convenient to distance themselves from the real high land territorial aristocracy, and are both interested in new money.
Yes, very much so. I mean, the Chips Channon connection with Edward the Eighth is very striking. I was particularly struck by what you quoted from The Spectator, Richard, where you said about the new sort of the new money and what went with it, namely the new corruption. It is dishonesty that kills national efficiency with a slow and horrible poison. It could be written about, you know, the oligarchs of today. And it was very striking that Edward the Seventh introduced this. Very few people, as you rightly say, could. Entertain him in the fashion that he was that he wanted to be accustomed to, and Edward the Eighth similarly. I mean, it was very, very striking that when he went down to Wales just before he abdicated, he went down to Wales and he was very sympathetic with towards the dispossessed and the unemployed in Wales. It was a famous visit, and he said at the end of that visit, something must be done. And he came back to London, and he went straight along to Bond Street and bought a huge jewel for Mrs. Simpson, and then he dined with Chips Channon in his extraordinarily lavish Belgrave Square house. And Chips was even slightly embarrassed by the splendour of the entertainment that he was given. And he sort of made some slightly deprecating remark. And Edward the Eighth said to him, no, I like splendour. So that I think, summed up his approach towards it. It was perhaps the succession of the plutocracy over the aristocracy.
Yes, there are two points here. Picking up on the word splendour, Edward VII is the man who restores splendour to the royal household and to the royal family. Queen Victoria's household tried to be more bourgeois than that of Louis Philippe, the citizen king in France, and the smartest thing is not to be smart. It's a very dowdy place, and the state of the royal palaces is terrible when he takes over, and he institutes most wonderful redecoration of the royal households. He says he has all the pictures rehung. He has the Buckingham Palace turned into a marvel of gilt and white and scarlet. And he says, I don't know much about art, but I do know about arrangement. and as he rehangs it, and he does bring splendour back, and indeed to the coronations. But certainly the plutocracy come to matter enormously in his reign. The fact that half of his favourite plutocrats are Jewish legitimises a great deal of anti-Semitism and certainly encourages the more nationalistic, imperialistic, ultra-right wing diehards to be very offensive about foreigners altogether and try to tried to make England more insular.
Yes, I think this is a most interesting point because Edward VIII, of course, was rather anti-Semitic. It's a question as how deeply anti-Semitic he was, but he and Mrs. Simpson were inclined to make opprobrious remarks about Jews. And you know, way after the end of the war, you find Edward VIII blaming the whole war on Roosevelt and the Jews, you know, as though this was what had caused the war. It's an extraordinary thing. But to come back to Richard's point, which I think is a very interesting one, this, I think, is a crucial difference between Edward VII and Edward VIII, that whereas Richard's brilliantly described the way in which he elevates splendor and makes this important. I mean, he did this not just inside Buckingham Palace, but the creation of the front of Buckingham Palace, the mall, the whole business of pageantry was something that he set great store by, and he looked the part. He had the charisma. He had the appearance of being a monarch in the traditional way. And pageantry, I think, was one of the crucial elements in the sustaining of the monarchy. And where Edward VIII was concerned, he thought it was all rot and flummery, and he couldn't bear to take part in all these pompous occasions. And he tried to weasel out of it where he could. And I think that this, although he was brilliant at projecting himself, much more so, I think, than Edward VII, because he went and he shook hands and he made speeches and so on. And he blamed Edward VII for just sort of snipping a few ribbons and laying a cornerstone and planting a tree and whatever, and then going back to his country house with his girlfriends, as Edward VIII put it. Whereas Edward VIII emoted, he went down, he shook hands with so many people that his right hand got injured, and he had to shake their hands with his left hand. So he did all this, and he projected himself out. But what he didn't do was to keep his distance. He unbent. Perhaps he unbent too much. I don't know whether Richard's got a view about this, but certainly pageantry was the great strength that Edward VII brought to the monarchy after Queen Victoria had been invisible for large parts of her career, the widow of Windsor and so on. Edward VII was every inch a king.
Yes, Queen Alexandra, his wife, complained that she felt like a character in a royal character in an Offenbach comic opera, because he did try to make the life of the royal family when it was in its capital as operatic as possible. And the point that that Piers has just made is absolutely spot on. I think the difference between the two men is that Edward VIII is colonial minded. And the colonies are full of informal dressing and people being chummy together and wearing shorts and swimming in lakes. And Edward VII is utterly European in his imagination and his cultural references. When he redesigns the pageantry and the palaces, he's copying what he's seen, particularly in Austria-Hungary, but also in the other European monarchies, which are very hierarchical kingdom, very hierarchical monarchies, with a lot of stultified grandeur about their public performance, and that's what he's copying, and more than that, what I think regard as an important bit of my book, is showing how when he becomes king, he regards himself as a European monarch. He doesn't see himself in national terms. And every year he goes for a month to the spa at Marienbad in Austria-Hungary, stays there for a month, and has a sort of alternate European court there so that people from all over Europe can come and see him, consult with him informally have meals with him and talk without notes being taken. And he walks around Marienbad, which is just a very beautiful small town, but it's just a spa town. And he does walk about there every day among the crowds. There were photographs of him there with the mobs of people standing and watching him and walking past him. And he's extremely accessible to the horror of his private detectives at a time when other monarchs all over Europe are being assassinated. So he's very much on show, but he does it in Europe because he wants to project his personality as a peacemaker throughout Europe.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think I would take issue with one aspect of your book, Richard, which was where you talk about his exercising power. You do say in your chapter heading that he exercised influence rather than power, but you also say that the Entente Cordiale with France in 1903-1904 was couldn't have been achieved without him. You don't go as far as Simon Heffer did in his book, which I thought was way over the top, where he claimed that Edward VII exercised power in a way that hadn't been done before. But if you look at what the politicians were saying, if you look at, what the Foreign Office was saying, that they were saying, well, Edward VII is a pawn rather than a king, or at least he must be told that he's a pawn rather than a king, that he mustn't, he shouldn't exercise too much power. He has no right to do that. And when he said that, when Gladstone heard that he wanted to become his own foreign secretary, Gladstone said that if he thought that he was going to do that, he'd soon find his Foreign Office in foreign parts, which is a very good response, I think, to the pretensions of monarchy. Now, what is interesting about this, I think it's an ambition that all royals have to exercise more than simply backstairs influence. Of course, Edward VII exercised backstairs influence. He had a huge influence. He stopped women appearing at court who rode astride on their horses in Rotten Row. So that was a sort of influence, but I think it was a sort of trivial thing, and I think his interference with the army, he had huge nuisance value. And similarly, where Edward VIII was concerned, he wanted to be influential, but he was very firmly slapped down, and the proof of the pudding, of course, was the abdication. You know, you are not going to do this, and if you do, well, I'm afraid you've got to go. Now, how do you answer that, Richard? Am I wrong about this?
Simon Heffer has written this book about the political power exercised by Edward VII, and it's full of very good stuff. But as I say in my book, I think he over-eggs the pudding at every stage. And of course, newspaper columnists attempted to do that because they never can allow themselves to be boring for very good reasons. I don't really find myself disagreeing very much with what Piers has said. The point really is that unexpectedly to me, the Conservative governments, or rather the Conservative coalition governments, because they had coalition support to stay in power, got on much worse with Edward VII than the Liberal governments that followed it. This is partly because the Conservative governments had some very feeble ineffectual ministers, particularly in the service ministries. And Edward VII gets exasperated by the casualness of the submissions that he gets from the War Office and from the Admiralty. It's to his credit. The Victorian army, one forgets, was incredibly shabby, fairly ill-disciplined in its drilling, but very badly dressed. And it is a much more disciplined and sprucer force as a result of Edward VII. But that's a small matter. The real matter is that he tries to have an alternate centralised diplomacy in his own head, which leads to the Entente Cordiale, but also leads to these ramified international treaties, which make it very difficult for Britain to hold out when war erupts in mainland Europe in 1914. And I do suggest in the book that if Edward VII had been alive, he would have been much more alert to the implications of what happened after the Sarajevo assassination and the treaty obligations that were involved and the mobilisation plans that started. He would have been warning Whitehall and the government much more sharply about the imminence of European wide war. And George V didn't go abroad as a king because of the tax deal that George V got in 1910 was that he wouldn't have to pay income tax if he paid for the cost of state visits. Foreign heads of state coming to London, he going to other capitals. And as a result of this, he only does two or three state visits in the 25 years of his reign to economise. And he's just not interested in Europe.
No. Amsterdam, Rotterdam and all the other dams. Damned if I'll go. That was very much his line, wasn't it?
Yes. I mean, he makes the British Empire much more important to the royal family than it had been. Edward VII was terribly bored by colonial office minutes and by the whole paraphernalia of militarism. He's the first monarch to have Indian Rajas at his coronation, but he doesn't read the papers and he thinks it's tiresome and preposterous stuff.
Yes.
That leads quite nicely to my next question, which was how you think the relationship with the people of the nation changed in terms of their view of monarchy and their kind of deference towards it, I suppose, between the two periods.
I think that, as Richard suggests in his book, that the deference had been growing probably from the late period of Queen Victoria when she became a kind of national institution and her popularity was boosted by the two jubilees towards the end of her reign. So I think it started then. It was helped, and this is something that I try to bring out in my book, helped by the emergence of the popular press. And what I say in my book is that Edward the Eighth was born just about at the same time as the Daily Mail, and the Beefeater Press sort of followed quite rapidly after that, and that helped to boost the fortune of the monarchy because the provincial press had tended to be rather radical and sometimes critical, whereas the Beefeater Press was absolutely four square behind the monarchy and the empire and identified the whole thing together. And I think that the press had a very important contribution to make to the boosting of the monarchy. I mean, Queen Victoria in her late period became a kind of goddess, really, the great white goddess, and that continued with Edward the Seventh, who was a fetish, paraded as a pageant, as Badgett said, and Edward the Eighth, similarly, you know, when he went on his imperial tours, he was adulated in the most extraordinary way. And this was, I don't say it was all got up by the press, but the press jolly well helped this to happen. And the press was extraordinarily deferential. I mean, Northcliffe wrote to the King, Edward the Seventh, private secretary, saying, look, don't just tell us what to write. Tell us what not to write about royals. So this was the owner of the Daily Mail saying that, and the rest of the press, I think, was similarly deferential. Even somebody like Beaverbrook, who was a sort of maverick, eventually came round and supported Edward the Eighth at the period of the abdication. I don't know whether you agree with that, Richard.
Yes, I think it's the press is hugely important. One important point involving the press is that until the First World War, the national press was much less important than the local newspapers. Local newspapers far outsold the London press, and it was only the appetite for war news that made Fleet Street paramount. And this had a great effect on national identity, because Edward VII, we talk about Edwardian England, we don't talk about Edwardian Scotland or Edwardian Wales or Ireland. We'd call him Edward VII, although he was in fact Edward I of Scotland. He was very much an English monarch, and the population, the wealth, the industrial power was very much in England during his reign, much more so, I think, than after the First World War and in Edward VIII's time. And so Edward VIII is the king of a democratic monarchy. Edward VII is not. The right to vote is not, there's not a right to vote in Edwardian England. You have property qualifications, which largely apply only to males. But there's a very restricted suffrage, much more restricted than people remember, much more complicated in its qualifications. And it is, after all, Edward VII finds that the Prime Minister has no formal role in ranking and precedence in the country. He doesn't count technically at all, and he insists that there's an order of precedence is instituted with the Archbishop of Canterbury on top, and then the Lord Chancellor, then the Archbishop of York, and only then the Prime Minister. So the politicians are definitely subordinated by the monarchy to the judiciary and to the Church of England. And that's an extremely different political and imaginative environment, the one that Edward VIII has to cope with. Mm.
I think that the press had a lot to answer for in this respect, because they successfully, of course, suppressed news of Edward VII's pleasant little failings, as one of his friends called them. Certainly his trips to foreign brothels and so on were absolutely under wraps. I mean, there were people who were critical. W.T. Stead, for example, publicly said that Edward VII as Prince of Wales was a wastrel and a whoremonger. But on the whole, the press kept that under wraps. And even more so where Edward VIII's peccadilloes were concerned, because he had a terrific, you know, he exercised droit de seigneur over society ladies and indeed had a whole lot of a great history of sexual conquests, and the press completely clammed up, and it clammed up even more when the Mrs. Simpson appeared on the scene in 1934. There were careful no references to it, not even when they went on this yachting trip in the Mediterranean in 1936 on board the Narlin, and the rest of the world's press were publicising this and showing the king in informal poses and showing Mrs. Simpson and so on. Everybody knew about it except the Brits, and so when it all blew apart, as it did in December 1936, the shock was absolutely colossal, much as it was during the 1990s, I suppose, when the young royals, you know, their peccadilloes came out and received the wash. But of course, the press was much, much less deferential in, largely, I suppose, Rupert Murdoch with his Republican agenda during the late 20th century. Whereas, you know, it came as a real shock to people in 1936. And Edward himself was shocked. And he said, you know, are they referring to the King of England, or was I some common felon? Because anything in the nature of an objective appraisal of the monarchy came as to seem to him and to many other people as the most arrant iconoclasm.
Piers's answer is a great relief to me, because I've worried that we were corruptly admiring one another too much, and I'm going to disagree with him, finally. at least as far as Edward VII goes, because Edward VII as Prince of Wales has a lousy press, which is he's incapable of managing. The most abusive and virulent things are written about him when he's involved in divorce cases, when he's involved in a particular gambling scandal called the Tranby Croft affair. He's hooted and booed in theatres and on racecourses and really reviled while he's Prince of Wales. This does stop out of respect for the monarchy once he becomes king in 1901.
Yes, but, I was. In my own defence, Rich, I was talking about his period as monarch.
Yes.
And, no, you're absolutely right, but, of course.
Yes.
I wouldn't disagree with that at
but
all.
Whereas Edward VIII has the most adoring press as Prince of Wales. He really is a glamour boy.
Yes.
Is hugely admired by the lower level of servants who work for him. I've been reading an account of him by his protection surveillance officer, who clearly idolised him, whereas the senior courtiers who had to deal with him at a grown-up business level were more and more infuriated and sickened by his irresponsibility.
Yeah, really, really shaken by him. I mean,
yes.
Lascelles, for example, his private secretary, when they were in Kenya together, King George V was ill, and Lascelles wanted him to go back, and instead, Lascelles records in his diary, he went off to seduce the wife of a district commissioner and accomplished this instead of immediately jumping in a train and a ship and so on and going back to his ailing father, who looked as though he was going to die at that point. He was more interested in this seduction, and Lascelles expresses then and at other times in the diaries a really frank contempt and almost loathing of Edward VIII, and which is in due course entirely reciprocated. The Duke of Windsor referred to that snake Lascelles, so it was very much a kind of a mutual dislike. But Lascelles was the voice of the establishment, really. You know, you do not behave like that. And what's interesting about Edward VIII as compared to Edward VII is that Edward VIII is unorthodox. I mean, he wanted to be called Edward the Innovator. Whereas Edward the Seventh was Edward the Orthodox, wasn't he? I mean, Edward the Caresser, no doubt, but he was Edward the Orthodox. He didn't, I think, have any feelings at all that that things should not go on as they always had gone on.
One of the characteristics of a disempowered monarchy that no longer has political clout or can intervene decisively in anything is that the monarchs become more and more absorbed by and fascinated by technical niceties and trivia. And the obsession with uniforms and clothes and dress and appearance of Edward VII and of George V is would now be thought OCD, though I don't think it was anything of the sort. But it was one of the ways in which the monarchs could still show power, admittedly on a rather, in many ways, on a pathetic level. And there's a wonderful account of Lord Salisbury, the Prime Minister, turning up for a royal audience with Edward VII in completely the wrong clothes. He's wearing the jacket of an elder of Trinity House and then a court trousers. And he's soundly rebuked by Edward VII and replies, I'm very sorry, Your Majesty, but it was a very dark morning and no doubt my mind was on smaller matters.
Yes, it was lovely. It's a brilliant story.
In what ways do you think these individuals in their reigns influenced the monarchy today? What do you think their influence and their legacy was?
Well, shall I start on this? I mean, I think that the legacy of Edward VIII, there's no question he shook the monarchy very badly, indeed. And it was perfectly clear that the monarchy could only survive, really, by closing ranks, by obliterating him from history, which is effectively what it does, keeping him abroad, writing him out of history. And a huge campaign was conducted to make him what his wife called the world's number one forgotten man. You know, he wasn't shown in the newsreels, he was kept out of the press and so on and so on, and he was kept abroad. And he tried to get back into the limelight by visiting Hitler and by doing all sorts of other things to get himself in the limelight, and that was much, much resented. And that was one element in the feud that went on. And the feud that went on, really, for as long as he lived, was to do with the fact that Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, felt that he had been responsible for her husband's death, because he had forced George VI to become George VI, and as George VI, of course, the strains and so on of office were almost more than he could bear. I think this was an exaggeration, but nevertheless, that happened. But where George VI was concerned, commitment to duty was absolute, and he just completely towed the line. And similarly, his daughter has completely towed the line. I mean, she has never in her life said anything of the slightest interest to anybody on a public occasion. She sometimes is overheard by microphones, but she doesn't do that. She doesn't do what Edward the Eighth did, which is sort of, you know, make noises of appeasing noises or anything controversial. She keeps out of controversy at all costs, and she knows that the essence of the monarchy is to be inclusive and not divisive. Really, I think you can say that her devotion to duty and her taking the middle path and being inclusive and not divisive for the whole of her very long reign has been part of the legacy of Edward the Eighth. I don't know whether that's your view.
Yes, absolutely. And also one of the legacies, a further legacy, which you hinted at, is a generation of Puritan inhibition in the royal family, which, as all periods of Puritan inhibition have had a tremendous, colourful counter-reaction in due course. But the inability of Princess Margaret to marry a divorced man, although there were, as I'm discovering, other issues in her choice of captain, group captain Townsend, that raised trouble. In the importance of Edward the Seventh to us today, a number of them. One of them is that he did create the landscape in London, which we now identify with the monarchy and with all public occasions. He laid out St. James's Park. He had what we all consider the front of Buckingham Palace is in fact the back of it. And he tried to turn it into a much more European palace facing the street and the people. And this was not a mere matter of symbolism. It involved an intensified identification of the subjects with their monarch. His family surname was Saxe Coburg and Gotha. He spoke German as equally well as he spoke English or French. He identified himself with the German-speaking peoples, Austria-Hungary, perhaps more than Germany or Prussia. He is hugely interested in everything that's happening in Europe. One of the reasons he likes Jewish multimillionaires so much is that they give him advanced news and confidential gossip from all the European capitals. And he has an amazing intelligence system of his own, which is one of the great solaces and pleasures of his life, as well as very important to the way he conducts himself. And he welcomed immigration. There's a huge influx of immigrants from not only escaping from Russian pogroms, but from Scandinavia and elsewhere in Europe, who come and Italians and French, who come to settle in England, particularly in London, during his reign. And this is a feature of his time that is much resented by the right wing and the nationalists, but very important in identifying the big features of his reign.
Do you think these stories have any lessons for us in the 21st century?
I think Edward VII has a great deal of significance for us, and Edward VIII too. But I think Edward VII, as Richard rightly described it, I mean, what the creation of Buckingham Palace as a great sort of backcloth to royal pageants is enormously important, with the Mall as the great processional way and so on. This is a sort of a very, very important creation, I think. And it emphasises the fact that, as the present Queen apparently once said, she's got to be seen to be believed. In other words, she's got to project herself. She needn't unbend too much. I mean, she can shake the odd hand, but she has got to be there as the national fetish. She's got to be there to be seen. And Edward VII emphasised the importance of this of pageantry as one of the elements of maintaining loyalty to royalty. So I think that that's very important. And I think that Edward VIII's legacy is simply that the monarchy is it's a quasi-religion. It's a form of been described as a form of British Shintoism. It only works if the populace as a whole can have some respect for the person involved. This worked perfectly for him as Prince Charming on his tours when he was visiting the poor and when he was sympathising with the poor. In practice, of course, he was actually pretty poor at philanthropy personally and feathered his own nest to a huge extent, an embarrassing extent, which was one of the causes of the difficulty with his successor. But it looked as though he was a kind of Lord Bountiful, you know, that he was there, he sympathised with the poor and so on. And he gained a great deal of respect for that, lost that respect, of course, owing to the Mrs. Simpson business. So I suppose what you can say about Edward VIII's legacy is that you've got to have respect for a monarch in order for the whole mad system to continue.
If you could travel back in time and ask someone a question, either the subject of your books or someone else, what would you ask?
I feel that Edward VII's eldest son, the Duke of Clarence, is a very hard done by figure. He died of pneumonia when he was in his 20s, and it was a really tragic turning point for his father, who kept pictures of him above his bed for the rest of his life. And I would like to... And the Duke of Clarence has been travestied by a lot of people. Some cretins pretend to think that he was Jack the Whipper. Others try to tie him up with a silly Went Boy scandal, and he's always presented as a total duffer. He seemed to me a reticent young man with fairly low self-esteem who was aware that he was in a very difficult situation. And I would like to meet him. I'd like to have really spent time with him and assessed him for myself, since I think the historical record of him is really unconvincing.
I've been thinking about this, and it seems to me that the crucial unanswered question about Edward VIII is, could he have lent himself to becoming a royal quisling, a kind of royal Führer? Had Hitler invaded this country in 1940, had Halifax, for example, been prime minister, had there been a deal, something of that kind, would Edward have become a kind of Pétain, a royal Pétain? Would he have convinced himself, because he was pro-Hitler, there's no question about that, that he was helping the salvation of the country in the way that Pétain thought that he was helping to save France from Nazism? Or would he have regarded this as a gross betrayal and a completely contemptible act? Some people thought that he would have become a royal quisling. Others thought not. My conclusion, such as it is that he was a patriot. I think he was a fool rather than a knave. I think he was taken in by Hitler. I think he thought fascism was fashionable. He went in for what was known at the time as Savile Row fascism. In other words, it was smart to be a fascist, you know. And he was taken in too by the fact that Hitler seemed to be solving one of the great unanswered problems of the 1930s, namely the problem of unemployment. And he did also worship strength. So there's a question, really. And I think it's a question that no historian can answer. Maybe we could only answer by going back and asking him, and maybe we wouldn't get a straight answer from him. But would he under those circumstances have lent himself? Would he have worn the swastika? Would he have acted as a sort of Gauleiter of England? It's an interesting and unanswered question, and there are a lot of people who are deeply hostile to Edward, particularly to his anti-Semitism, who would say yes, you know, he was a scoundrel. I don't think he was a scoundrel. I think he was a very shallow, foolish, philistine, ignorant person, and was taken in by the fashions of the time.
He was, of course, so emotionally submissive that I think that he would have been wonderful for the part of a puppet monarch of Hitler's, and would have done it quite well for about 9 months. But he was also so pettish and touchy and ultimately irresponsible that he would then have fallen enormously foul of Hitler and would have had a plane crash.
That's a wonderful scenario, Richard, which I think I enter into completely.
And finally, if your books could change people's impression of these people and the world in which they lived, how would you like it to do that?
I asked the question towards the end of the book, you know, if you could quit on a whim, which is what Edward the Eighth did, if you showed really that you were unfit to be king, doesn't this open the door to the essential Republican argument, namely that a hereditary system, a system whereby the heir to the throne is chosen by a genetic lottery, doesn't that invalidate the whole argument? And I suppose that is the seed that I would like to sow in the minds of unsophisticated readers.
Well, all my best decisions are sudden and personal decisions are sudden and arbitrary and capricious. I'm a great. I don't think people take better decisions after lots of rational thought. And I like the arbitrary selection of the head of state by a genetic inheritance, particularly as I always have a nightmare of who one would have as a head of state instead, some terrible old party hack.
That's the Achilles heel of my argument.
And I simply couldn't bear it, and I'd have to go and live in Belgium, where there would still be a monarchy.
That was Richard Davenport-Hines and Piers Brendan. Edward VII, the cosmopolitan king, and Edward VIII, the uncrowned king, are both out now, published by Allen Lane.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does, or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest, whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 40%. Up to 40% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Now it's time for the latest history news with our digital editor, Emma Mason.
Henry VIII's flagship, the Mary Rose, has been revamped to give visitors a better idea of what life would have been like for its crew. At the purpose-built museum in Portsmouth, which houses the warship, small viewing panels have been replaced with floor-to-ceiling windows and a balcony entered through an airlock. The ship, which sank in July 1545 in the Battle of the Solent, has undergone 34 years of conservation since it was raised from the seabed in 1982. The £39 million Mary Rose Museum first opened its doors to visitors in May 2013. The latest revamp, which saw the ship closed to public viewing in November 2015, cost around £5.4 million to complete. Conservation manager Dr. Eleanor Schofield said it was a, quote, emotional moment. It feels like you can reach out and touch it. You get a sense of the compartments and relate it all to the artefacts and the people on board, she said. Hundreds of men aboard the Mary Rose drowned when it sank in 1545, and only around 25 survived. The most likely reason for the loss of the ship was human error, according to the Mary Rose Museum. In other news, a new permanent exhibition at the Churchill War Rooms in London is to show how the former Prime Minister became so irritated by his noisy co-workers that he banned whistling and imported bespoke noiseless typewriters for his staff. Titled Undercover: Life in Churchill's Bunker, the exhibition will reveal the day-to-day life of working for Winston Churchill, including testimony from a handful of staff members who worked closely with Churchill in his war rooms. The exhibition will feature a printed sign warning them against whistling in the corridors and special typewriters the Prime Minister ordered from the US to eradicate the tapping that so annoyed him, The Telegraph reports. Meanwhile, doodles in one of Leonardo da Vinci's notebooks, previously dismissed as, quote, irrelevant notes, in fact prove the key to his theory of friction, it has been suggested. Academics at the University of Cambridge believe hand-drawn diagrams and notes found in the page of a tiny book dating from 1493 and held in the V&A archive show how Leonardo started thinking about the force of friction on two sliding surfaces. After re-examining the drawings, which were described by a director of the V&A in the 1920s as, quote, irrelevant notes and diagrams in red chalk, Professor Ian Hutchings believes they show how Leonardo began sketching out his ideas. Professor Hutchings said, the sketches and text show Leonardo understood the fundamentals of friction in 1493. Leonardo is today credited with developing the laws of friction, despite not seeing the work recognised in his lifetime.
Now here's a reminder that our August issue is currently on sale. Inside this month's magazine there are articles on Eleanor of Aquitaine, the Cultural Revolution, the Ancient World, and the historical context of Britain's vote to leave the EU. You can get hold of our August issue in all good newsagents in the UK and internationally in our many digital formats. Outside the UK, it may still be an earlier edition that's currently in the shops. And if you'd like to take out a subscription, we currently have a great deal available for new subscribers in the United States, where you can try 3 issues of the magazine for a total of just $9.95, including postage. You can find out more and take advantage of this offer by visiting buysubscriptions.com/historyUS. And just before we go, I'd like to mention a new podcast that's been produced by one of our historical advisors, Professor Rab Houston. The series is called The History of Psychiatry in Britain Since the Renaissance, and the first 2 episodes are already available to download. You can find the episodes at arts.st-andrews.ac.uk/psychhist, as well as on SoundCloud. Well, that's pretty much it for this episode, but do listen in next week when we'll be talking about the history of the ancient world, among other things.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. And for more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com. It's packed with articles, quizzes, image galleries, and much more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.